Well, welcome to another episode of Breakaway from the Rat Race. And today I have the pleasure of meeting with Peter Neal and Ron Lockhart. And they're both co-founders and managing partners of GSP REI. It's a vertically integrated real estate investment company. They're specializing in acquiring, developing, and managing single family rentals for the affordable and workforce rental housing market. Ron has over 29 years of experience in real estate investing and construction management. Peter has over 9 years of real estate investing and capital raising experience. And together, they are committed to providing the tenants exceptional rental experience and their investors with above average returns. So guys, welcome to the show, Peter, Ron.
Hey, thanks for having us. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. So it was a little bit of a mouthful at the beginning. Sorry about that. But so this is great. So, I mean, I love the single family rental market. I think this is one of the least saturated market out there. And there's always some good opportunity. It's one of the best way for me to invest and for people that want to get started. So tell us about why you guys chose single family rentals as your investment vehicle.
Yeah, well, I'll kind of start, and then Ron, you could probably finish up where I leave off. But so we look at supply and demand. You know, as investors, you know, we were looking at what asset class has the least supply and the most demand, and single family in as a whole, and then when you take it one step further, as in the affordable workforce housing space, properties valued under $250,000 to $200,000 of value, they're becoming more and more of a rare asset. When you look at the data, housing supply in general, we're not building the way we were pre-2008. So we're not keeping up with with new housing formations when it comes to that. And when you look at the data on, houses valued under $200,000, there's such a small percentage of new houses being created. So there's a ton of opportunity in certain markets when it comes to like blighted properties, fully distressed properties, where somebody like us who has the background in the construction and the property management, and we do all that in-house, we can find a lot of opportunities. We're not competing with, regular home buyers. We're buying distressed properties that need work. We go in, we do the construction, the renovation, and then we either sell the property off at a markup from what we bought it at, or we keep it as a rental, ideally, and continue to manage it from there. So, and Ron kind of runs the construction side of our business. He can probably speak to a little bit more on, why we focus on the single family side in that perspective.
25 years ago, when I got into the real estate business, it was through construction. And I had a new home building company that was in the Mid-Atlantic region, did that for a number of years, but at some point we started buying properties that were more investment focused. So we weren't just selling properties. We were holding them, smaller multifamily buildings. And I really found that I preferred that side of the business than just building homes. But I also realized that building homes and the construction piece of the business was central to us creating value in the properties that we were buying and developing. Whereas if you have to contract a third party to do that, you're losing margin and you're losing the ability to build equity in properties right out of the gate. So in the early 2000s, we really got into the investing side of the business. I was a partner in a real estate finance company. I've consulted. I was a development services partner for government services entities through the National Community Stabilization Trust. And what that meant was we were approved to take assets from HUD and other government affiliated entities and redevelop them. And a core component of that was you had to be able to perform the construction piece of the business. A lot of the assets that we were getting through that program were, I don't want to use the term lower end, but they were below $400,000.
Yeah.
And after 2017, 2018, we noticed that a lot of these made sense for rentals. And that's when we really started to focus more on building our rental portfolio than a disposition strategy. And more specifically, we saw a real need in the affordable housing space. You know, a problem that continues to evolve today. When you look at the housing crisis, yes, we have a historically low supply, but beyond that, there's an even greater lack of supply for affordable housing. I mean, that is the true housing crisis that the country is facing right now. I know Peter's heard me say this 100 times. I've always been a big believer, you know, stay in your lane. If you find something that works for you, continue to do it. And that's one of the reasons I always focused on single family. We've done it for 25 plus years. We've done it well. To Peter's point earlier about the way our company's set up, we're vertically integrated. Our construction's in-house, our asset management's in-house, our property management's in-house. And that allows us to control all facets of the cycle from acquisition to development to rental and stabilization. So it's not that we haven't looked at multifamily and that multifamily doesn't make sense and there's good returns there. We just do this really well. And we believe that we can continue to scale with single family. You know, everybody has their comfort zones. We're very comfortable here. We don't mind the scattered site dynamic of single family housing. We actually like it. We think it plays to our strengths. So that's really the primary reason why we focus on single family.
So let's talk about, I mean, I totally agree. I mean, when we're looking at the supply, a lot of people, all the news is about kind of like the retail market, the single family retail market. And it's very different when you're looking at the single family rental space. It tends, as you mentioned, Ron, it tends to be like lower end prices if you're looking for cash flowing rental properties. And also, you know, it's just very different in terms of kind of how these two markets behave and how the value that you're adding and stuff like that. Would you mind like contrasting kind of like the single family retail versus the single family rentals? If I'm going to be investing, what's the big difference between if I want to flip a house in the retail space versus if I want, well, you're not really flipping, but if you were to flip or invest in a single family rental?
So we do at times have a disposition strategy, but you know, there are a lot of factors that play into whether a single family home makes a good rental property. You know, if from a retail standpoint, if you're selling the property, the property taxes don't play as big a role because they're not factoring into, you know, to your expenses going forward if you're holding the property for rental to make the numbers work. So, you know, and then also, you know, when you're selling retail, you know, typically it's to an end user, a home buyer, where they're more constrained by affordability than they are by making the numbers work if they were to try and turn it into an investment property. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the rental side of things, there's just more factors at play. You know, it's being able to acquire at the right price, because in this environment, it's really hard to find a property that you purchase that is rent ready. You know, the numbers just aren't going to work. You need to have some type of value add. So it's, can you buy right? It's, can you perform the construction or renovation at the right numbers to create some value and some equity, because you're going to want to refinance the property. And you need to make sure that you're pulling enough capital back out of it when you do the refinance. It's interest rates. It's a number of factors that play into, does the property cash flow and does the return on investment work?
Mm-hmm. So what are some of the markets? So, I mean, when you look at this, I mean, your strategy, did you start by looking at it like, look in your backyard and say, hey, we have tons of those around us? Or did you have to kind of like really find the markets where it made sense, your strategy made sense?
So where we're located outside of Philadelphia made sense.
Mm-hmm.
The way that market is constructed from a tax standpoint, from an entry point, it made sense. It's gotten more challenging over the years as it's become more competitive. New Jersey, which is another market that we invest in, that's a little more challenging. Taxes tend to be higher there. So you're relegated to certain geographic regions of New Jersey for it to actually make sense. The other market that we're involved in is Baltimore. We're a big fan of Baltimore right now. We spent about 18 months researching that market before we started investing there. And I think we bought our first property 4 years ago in Baltimore. And we continue to buy more and more and more. You know, obviously, you have to have the demand in any of these markets for them to make sense. We like metropolitan areas. We like to invest around certain economic drivers like hospitals, life sciences, where there's job creation and there's a need. We're not just going scattershot and buying cheap properties in different areas and trying to renovate them. We're very strategic how we buy. So the other thing from a geographic standpoint, we want to be able to look, feel, touch. We want our own people working on these properties. Again, we don't want to have to use third parties. We're fortunate that the markets that we're in, we could buy 500 properties a year for the next 5 years. And between those three markets, we really wouldn't scratch the demand there. I mean, the surface of the demand. The demand is significant, especially when you get into the subsidized housing. A market like Baltimore has a backlog of over 10,000 Section 8 vouchers. I mean, it's staggering. Philadelphia has a huge backlog to the point where they're not even issuing new vouchers in Baltimore until they can have the housing to satisfy at least some of the demand.
Oh, that's incredible. So yeah, these are some of the market that we looked at Baltimore a while back, you know, for some of our investments. Right now we're more into like the St. Louis, Cleveland, Detroit, and all that, and these kinds of areas. And so it's kind of interesting that, so, I mean, you started in Philadelphia and then you went and explored to other markets that, so it's kind of interesting to see that and how you picked and analyzed Baltimore before you kind of like decide to invest in that. And I think that's something that's important. A lot of the investors that I don't know where your investors are coming from, but a lot of our investors are coming from kind of like the coast, the West Coast and the East Coast. And then what happens is that they can't do anything in their backyard. And so they're looking at us into you to basically invest in something that made more sense, things that are cash flowing, things that appreciate at still at a very good rate. So we had, it sounds like we had like similar criteria. Yeah. One of the other criteria we had was around the landlord friendly kind of state, things that make it, you know, a little bit easier for us to you know, get rid of tenants if they're not paying, compared to a California where, you know, it's almost impossible to get rid of tenants even if they're not paying. So,
yeah.
So let's talk about the, so these are some of the markets. Is there any other markets that you're looking at that it could be of interest to your company and your fund, your investment fund?
Yeah, I mean, we're always looking at other markets. It's funny you mentioned Cleveland, because Cleveland's one that I've had my eye on and have been doing research. We actually like Alabama. That's a little bit further. You know, it's obviously not close to home. So for us to make any move to a market like that, we'd want to be able to set up some type of infrastructure there. But there's a couple of markets in Alabama we like on the affordable housing side. You know, again, it's a major problem in the country. There's a lot of markets that have this demand and this need. So, you know, we're always listening and we're always looking. But we've got enough on our plate right now where we are that, you know, to shift focus would probably do our investors a disservice right now.
Mm-hmm. So some
there's certainly efficiencies created in scale with a single family portfolio, similar to the efficiencies of scale and multifamily. So the larger the portfolio is, the more key in-house hires you can make, the more efficiencies you can have in the property management and the construction management. And also, we tend to be pretty laser focused right now for the markets that we're in. But to Ron's point, there are some other local markets too, like Reading and Lancaster and York. And like there's places in PA that we could go to as well. But we like those metropolitan areas where we can scale up within there. So that's kind of been what we've been thinking the last couple of years.
Yeah. I mean, some of our investors too, they're kind of like, they're independent investors that are part of Flip System or of Martel Turnkey. And then, yeah, they always kind of, I want to go into another market and stuff like that. It's just like why? You're good in this market. You have a good relationship with your property manager. Just keep buying in that area. Like why go and try, you know, there's a whole sense of, yes, there's some sense of diversification that you want to do. Like, let's say this city goes down for whatever reason, and the unemployment goes through the roof, but this other city would not be impacted somehow by that. So it's kind of it's kind of interesting. People are always trying to find, what's the next hottest market and be involved in as many market as possible. When you have a good thing going, just keep at it. Tweak the the saw, whatever the word was, and just keep working at it. And as you mentioned, Ron is Peter is you can then hire the right people. You know, you can kind of build your team, solidify your team, make better hire or key hire to really help grow the company. And then once you're solid, then kind of like think about expanding.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I think we share. We share in that thought, around diversification, that there's a fine line. Yeah, I think diversification is important. And for our investors who invest in a lot of, fund opportunities, 506B and C type fund opportunities, I hear that a lot. There's some people who are, around tax time, they're getting 40, 60, 100 different K-1s from, a million different syndications they're in, and they want to pull their hair out. But for whatever reason, the diversification thing, or it just becomes fun. It's like they're collecting, baseball cards or something at that point. But there's a lot of other people who I agree with the thought process of, get into you want diversification to a certain point. But you really want to understand those things that you're investing in and the intricacies. So it's like, you might be in single family, but a different market will operate in a different way, or there could be different things going on in that market that could drive things up or down. And I think it's important to diversify over a couple things that you really understand. And if you are going to be passive, whether it be through like a turnkey or a fund or something like that, to have a really good relationship with the person you're working with, you can't beat that at the end of the day. And they can share their insight and that kind of thing. So I totally agree with you when it comes to the importance of diversification, but there's certainly a fine line, and you can kind of overdo it and overcomplicate your life too, and expose yourself to maybe some higher risk when you get into things maybe that you don't have as much research on or understand, that kind of thing.
Yeah. And so GSP REI, is a real estate investment company. And is that the fund that you're running?
That's the managing entity of a few different funds. So since inception, we've had four different fund offerings, and GSP REI is the managing entity.
Okay. So if people want to work with you guys, so they would go to your website, and then they would go and say they would see a couple of funds that they can invest in. So what is the difference between the different funds? Did you do it by just because you have like a certain amount and then you kind of build the portfolio around that? Or is it by city, or how did each of the funds differ?
Yeah, that's a good question. So there are always going to be a cap on the funds. And I mean, like with the SEC and a 506 fund, they require you to cap it at some point. So the two funds we're raising capital for now are both $25 million offerings. So once we would hit that, we would have to close those funds. And we don't have to raise that much capital. It's just, you know, just kind of where we cap those at. But for us, the way that our funds are broken up is one we call the income fund and the other we call the growth fund. And the income fund feels very much like debt. So the investor will pick a term, whether it be 1 year, 3 years, or 5 years, and then they'll have an interest rate associated with that term. And so it's kind of like a fixed rate, fixed term. So you invest for 1 year, you get 9%. They invest for 3 years, they get 10. 5 years, they get 12. And they could take monthly distributions, or they can take they can compound those distributions for a greater return. And there's no real tax advantage in a structure like that. You know, it's the advantage is more the predictable income of it. And then like you could do it through an IRA. It doesn't generate UBIT. So a lot of people like that as well. And then for some, so it's going to feel very much like debt, but technically it's an equity investment and they're collateralized to the assets that the fund owns. The growth fund is more of a traditional like syndication where investors receive a preferred return. That feels very much like our income fund. Like that's their baseline. That's their monthly payment. And then they share in the profit and the equity of the fund 50-50. So we split everything above the preferred return. 50 goes to the investor, 50 goes to us, the managers. So they're getting semi-annual checks on the profit upon availability, and then they have their equity that they can realize at some point in the future. You know, we look at it as like a 5 to 7 year term, but we give investors the ability to get out after the third anniversary upon our availability of capital and if they would like to do that. And they can also stay in longer if they would like. So to Ron's point before, like we're not really a disposition strategy. You know, we're typically, we like to sell assets at any given time, but you know, for the most part, we want to do refinances and continue to redeploy and the capital that way. So we like to create liquidity more through the refis than through disposition events. So that does have the tax advantages. You know, essentially, you own 50% of the assets in the fund. I mean, so you get 50% of all the tax advantages as well through a K-1 will trickle down to the investors.
Okay. Yeah, that was kind of my question about the profit. What was the profit? And I thought that your growth fund was kind of like doing a disposition at the end of the project, but you're just basically doing a refinance at the end of the project. And then basically the profit would come from the cash flow of the property. Okay. And you get 50. What's the preferred on that one?
We pay a 6% preferred return, and the fund projects, I think it's a 20 to 23% compound annual growth rate, and the average cash yield is between 8 to 11%. So above the 6% preferred return, you should be getting an average annual return, an average annual cash yield closer to like 8 to 11%.
Okay, well, that's cool. And then on the growth fund, you're buying distressed property, renovating it, refinancing in the back end. Are you doing the same thing with the income fund?
The strategy is exactly the same. It's just the structure is different. So, you know, what we do, like kind of to give you our model is we typically want to be all into a property for under $120,000. Okay. And that could be a property that we buy for $100,000, put $20,000 into it. So kind of like a value add, or it could be ideally a property we buy for $20,000 and put $100,000 into it. Yeah. And then that will ideally appraise on the low end of about 165, closer to about 185. And then we can rent that property on average about $1,650 a month. So we'll do portfolio refis. So it's kind of like a Burr method, essentially, where we get a certain amount of asset value. We'll do a portfolio refi, and typically we're going to get, you know, 30-year financing on that, so via, you know, fixed rate. So we like, you know, that's kind of our strategy overall, whether we're doing it in the income fund or we're doing it in the growth fund.
Okay, excellent. And then, so obviously with the growth fund, you get a share, the K-1 basically is, you're getting a K-1 out of that one. So any kind of depreciation or tax advantage, you're going to be taken care of by the K-1. Your income fund, you're getting a 1099
So they get a K-1 too. Yeah. So okay. The investors get a K-1. It's just the fixed rate nature of it puts the distribution in a different box, which is taxes ordinary income.
Okay. Cool. Very good. That's unfortunate, but yeah. No depreciation on that. You don't get the depreciation on that one.
No. Yeah, exactly. There's no real, like when you do a fixed rate nature like that, it really feels like debt. You know what I mean? So okay. It's kind of, there's no way to really share the depreciation along to the investor.
Okay.
So that's why people like it in like an IRA, because they're getting it, the tax advantage through their IRA. And then the other thing too, is like people outside of the IRA, it's predictable in that sense. You know what I mean? Like they're not, their return's not dependent on upside.
So what's the return that you're getting on your income fund?
So that's between 9 or 12%, depending on the term that they choose. So if they invest for 1 year, it's like a 9%. And that feels like interest only. You know what I mean? So whatever you invest, you take 9% of it. They invest for 3 years, it's 10. 5 years, it's 12. So it feels very much like an interest only payment. So you take, whatever the rate is, divide that by 12, and that's your monthly payment.
Okay, that's great. And then on the growth fund, you get the 6%. So obviously you get a premium when you get into the income side, but you don't get
the upside. Yeah. So it's like a delay reward in a sense. I mean, so the less preferred return we send out, the more properties we can buy.
Yeah.
And the more properties we can buy over time, the more cash flow they'll have in the upside and the tax advantage. The other thing too is when you factor in the tax advantage, sometimes you can make less but actually keep more. So there's a couple different factors that go into it. But in all, just one of the reasons we always did income funds, and my background in capital raising and in real estate was raising capital for income fund structure. So it was one of those things where when we started, we did it that way because that was what we knew. And yeah. I knew people and investors who liked that structure. So chances are they would invest with us. The growth fund really came out of, just 9 years of people asking me for upside and tax advantages. You know what I mean? Like, because a lot kind of, I feel like we're probably about 50-50 with investors who want predictable monthly payment. They don't care about the tax advantage. They're getting in other investments that they're in. You know, they just want that, somewhat predictable side of it. The other thing too that's like different about our income fund is the fact that typically between 60-70% of our portfolio is subsidized at any given time. So that's a huge advantage compared to other income funds where, maybe the assets backed aren't getting subsidized rents.
Yeah.
But then, you have the other 50% of investors who, they want more of the upside and the tax advantages and that kind of thing. So it was kind of something that grew out of people asking us for it and those focus group type conversations to come up with structures that would try to satisfy both income and growth type investors.
Yeah. And then of course, these funds are accessible or available only for accredited investors. So
we do five. And the reason I can talk about like the returns openly on a forum like this is we do 506C funds. So we require everybody to have to do accreditation. And, we have to have something on file that shows that.
Yeah. And then you have also, you have like a, what's that called? PPM.
Yeah, private place memorandum. Yeah, the subscription docs, operating agreement, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So that sounds great. So in terms of the market, so all of those are diversified into multiple markets or not?
Yeah, our funds are pretty much collateralized to Baltimore, Philadelphia, and New Jersey. Okay. For the most part, our main focus right now has been Baltimore and Philadelphia. Leaning more towards Baltimore for a number of different reasons. Primarily that's our funds are going to be focused in those geographic areas.
So what are some of the challenges when you open a market like Baltimore that you opened, like, I think like 4 years ago, you mentioned, and you want to do everything internally at the beginning, did you start with like independent contractors to do all the renovations and then you kind of like start hiring other people? Or so how did you build your team, basically?
Yeah,
your internal team on the ground there?
That's a great question, Ron. You could take that one.
Sure. So we've got a pretty big labor force up here that's been built over 10 to 20 years, we'll bring our own crews down. So some of the early houses that we buy, we'll rotate our crews from up here outside of Philadelphia. They'll live down there, and we'll just rotate them out. So like I said, we like to have full control over what we're doing. So that's what I mean. When I talked about if we ever went into another market, we'd want to set up the infrastructure, have our people there. So, I mean, you know, obviously when you're moving into a new market and you're bringing people down there logistically, there's, you know, can be some bumps in the road, but we've been doing this a long time. So we're pretty good at getting people set up and getting them going. You know, anytime you move into a new market, beyond the research of, you know, what's a good buy and what can you rent a home for, there's always some politics to a new market. There's permitting, there's licensing, there's local government. So there's always some nuances that you figure out. Takes a little bit of time, nothing that you can't overcome, but you know, those would be the early challenges when you move into a new market.
Have you any challenges around the Section 8? Well, actually, first question, what's the percentage of these houses that are Section 8?
Typically around 60 to 70% of our portfolio will be receiving, the tenant will be receiving a Section 8 voucher.
Okay, well, that's cool. And then what's the, in terms of the interest rate, I mean, the interest rate fluctuation over the last, you know, year or so, 2 years, and how does that impact your business?
So even when interest rates were down, when we were doing portfolio refinances at 4.25%, we built our model around 7% interest rates, and then we even stress it up to 10. Mm-hmm. So we were doing that long before rates started to move up, so we were comfortable as rates started moving up. Obviously we didn't want to see it happen, but we were comfortable that we had gone beyond where we thought they might end up, and it wouldn't affect our model. Obviously, it squeezes your margin a little bit, but it still kept us very profitable.
Okay, well, that's good.
So the other part of it too is being conservative on the rents. So like we're typically going to be somewhere between 16, 1650. We're modeling out like a 1475 rent, you know, and just to be ultra conservative. And that's something we felt too, is as interest rates went up, rents kind of went along with it. But for our model, we try to factor in, what's the sensitivity analysis kind of, you know, I mean, if the rents go this way and the interest rates go that way, you know, I mean, I think it's important for investors to look at it in a number of different ways and factor those in.
Yeah. Any particular challenges dealing with Section 8? Obviously, you have a lot of experience doing that with 70% of your portfolio in Section 8. Any particular challenges?
I mean, the most difficult piece to Section 8 is really before the tenant even moves in, to be honest with you. In a market like Philadelphia, they have a very stringent inspection process. So understanding what that is and what the requirements are can save you a lot of time and money. Baltimore, there's a lot of paperwork. You have to submit something that's called a RAFTA. It has to be approved. They come back and they give you a rent that they're willing to pay or that the tenant qualifies for. And then they give you a split on what the tenant's responsible for and what the government's paying for. You can reject it, you can accept it. It's understanding those processes up front and what goes into it, because you can lose a lot of time there if you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah. Something exactly. So sometimes that's what happens. You just kind of, we have some situations like this when we knew that we wanted to rent the property, but we didn't know that we were not planning to necessarily do Section 8. So we did the renovations a certain way, and then we say, let's do Section 8 instead because we can get more rent. And then, so there was an additional inspection that had to happen in our market. And then we had to bring the contractor back and then spend some more money to fix little things like handrails and stuff like that. So some electric panels and stuff like that. But not insurmountable. It's just like, you know, this is something to be aware of. If you know right up front that you're going to do Section 8, then you can, as you mentioned, you know, you can save a lot of time. You can save some money and get your tenants in there.
Absolutely.
So anything else you want to share about your fund, real estate investing, where the market is going?
Well, I think it sounds like we share in a love for single family rentals. And I mean, I think the market over the past couple of years, multifamily has been really hot. And we always joke, you know, people ask us all the time if we're going to graduate up to multifamily. And, you know, I think you're going to start to see a lot of multifamily investors. I don't know if the term would be graduate down or what they're going to do, but you start to do more and more.
You're improving family. Your returns. I think you're graduating.
Exactly. Well, I'll have to try to coin a phrase before it happens. But the other thing too, is I think a lot of investors have gone that route because they can hire third party property management that makes sense. And I mean, and you know, cause they don't have the construction and the property management internally. They don't want to do those things. They don't want to deal with those challenges, and there's nothing wrong with that. You know what I mean? I wouldn't knock anybody for it. You know what I mean? Like I talked to my dad or my brother and they would never want to do those kinds of things. So I get it. But I think the future and like a trend that people should be looking for is single family. I don't think there's another asset class that has the supply and the demand metrics right now that single family does. And I just take it one step further to like the workforce affordable housing side. Those $200,000 properties and under are becoming more and more rare. You know, I mean, it's just they're not developing new ones. So there's a ton of opportunity in revitalizing those types of properties. You know, you're not competing typically with retail home buyers. If you're doing $80,000 to $100,000 in renovation, you know, there's not too many first time home buyers that are doing that. And then you have a lot of flexibility on what you want to do. That's kind of, to go back to a question you had brought up in the beginning about, you know, retail versus rent. It's important when you get into a rental market that there is a strong retail market behind that. So you have that flexibility. If a property maybe isn't performing the way you want it to, or, you know, if your property management isn't performing the way you want it to or something like that, you have the flexibility to sell the properties that maybe are causing you more headache or something like that. So we certainly like the flexibility when it comes to, it can be the end could be a retail sale, or it could be you could be selling to a portfolio to investors, or you could be keeping it as a rental, that kind of thing. So there's a lot of different flexibilities in it, but I definitely think for the listeners, single family is a good place to be. And I think you're going to see more and more trends going towards the single family space. So it should be interesting to watch. It's a fun market to be in right now.
You're right. I mean, I love single family rentals, obviously. I also have an apartment buildings, but, you know, there's so many reasons why I think single family rental is the best right now. Maybe later on it's going to change. You have to go to the investment where you're going to maximize your return. You're going to have more exit strategies with single family rentals. When you're high interest rate, also, it affects people differently. An investor with a high interest rate, they don't really care about high interest rate as long as it's cash flowing and you have a good cash on cash return. When you have a high interest rate on the retail home, well, that hits my wallet directly. So changes dramatically. Also, if we have to hit a recession, don't know, don't have a crystal ball, but if we do, you know, people downgrade from the luxury and A, and they downgrade to the B and C class, which is kind of like where we are in the workforce housing and all that kind of stuff. So,
yeah, for the listener, there's a Nuveen study, which is the asset management division of the Teachers Insurance and Annuities, TIAA. And you can look it up on Google. It's a study that they did on affordable housing, and they looked at affordable housing over the last 20 years. And in recessions, the yield was more favorable than any other asset class. So that's market rate apartments. It's, you know, retail like strip centers and other, you know, industrial product, and, you know, you name it, office building, all the other asset classes. And a lot of that was had to do with just the sheer demand, and then, you know, not seeing as many concessions and things like that during times of recession. So it's an interesting study, and they take it a lot further and talk about a lot of different things. And if you go on our site, I think in the Learn section,
okay,
you heard an article about it, but it's a really cool study. It gives a lot of insight into the affordable housing space. So that's another kind of trend, I think, for the listeners to be keeping an eye out for. I mean, a lot of institutional buyers have been expanding their foothold in the affordable space. They tend to lean towards the multifamily because they have billions of dollars they need to deploy, and that's an easier space to do it. But at the end of the day, you know, the subsidy of the rent and the demand's the same, whether I think it's even stronger in the single family side. So I think affordable housing is another trend to look at moving forward. And I think every serious real estate investor should have affordable housing represented in their portfolio in some way, shape or form.
Yeah, very true. So the obviously other trends in there that are also impacting the single family rental. I mean, I'm not going to talk about all of them now, but yeah, look it up. Ron, Peter, if people want to have, they want to connect with you, they want to maybe invest in your funds, where can they reach you?
Yeah, gsprei.com is our website. They can do everything there on the contact page. They can schedule time with us in person at our office, over the phone. My email's there, and our phone number's there. You know what I mean? So all the contact information they need is on our site, as well as opportunity to download our pitch deck and review our offerings and webinars and things like that we've done. So that's a great place to get started. And then, like I say, we're always available for phone calls and emails and things like that. So once you get the contact info, be sure to reach out to us.
Great. Peter, Ron, thank you very much.
Cool.
Thanks for having us. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Eric. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Break Away from the Rat Race with your host, Eric Martel. If you want to share your story and experience with our listeners, please message us on Facebook at Break Away from the Rat Race. Also, please subscribe to our YouTube channel and our podcast on iTunes.